Here's a few quick notes about the show. Southern Girl Crime Stories is a podcast focused mostly on lesser-known true crime cases that range from murders, missing persons, cold cases, soft cases, and more. Please be sure to check out my YouTube channel for these stories, along with photos of victims, suspects, locations of murders, and more. Brenda Lee Spicer was born on June 4, 1968. In 1987, 18-year-old Brenda was a student at Northeast Louisiana University in Monroe, Louisiana, where she was a member of the basketball team. However, on February 10th, she withdrew from the school due to an injury that was preventing her from playing and returned to her hometown of Jenna, Louisiana. On March 5th, she returned to school to hang out with her friend and former roommate, Joel LaShawn Tillis, who was a star basketball player for the college. Since it was Joel's last game, they had plans to celebrate, but unfortunately would never get the chance. Brenda dropped Joel off at the stadium for her game at 5:45 p.m. After Joel's game, Brenda was nowhere to be found. Immediately thinking something was wrong, she called the police and reported her missing. By the next morning, when there was still no sign of Brenda, she called the police once again. They began retracing her steps and found her car parked near the stadium. Investigators found a strange card inside the glove box that appeared to be from a disgruntled person. This person was upset about Joel and Brenda hanging out together and called her a whipped puppy. The card was signed by Joel's fiance, Irvin Bolden Jr., who was a medical student at the college. At 7:58 a.m., Brenda's half-nude body was found in a dumpster on the Northeast Louisiana University campus. She had sadly been strangled to death, and her time of death was around 7 p.m. on March 5th, 2 hours after she was last seen. The medical examiner also found signs to suggest she might have been sexually assaulted. It turns out that Irvin was jealous of Joel and Brenda's friendship, and they had argued about it on several occasions. He then forbade Joel to hang out with Brenda, but she did anyway. When Irvin was brought in for questioning, he admitted to meeting Brenda outside the stadium on March 5th after she dropped Joel off. However, he claimed he went to the game and had nothing to do with Brenda's death. Two witnesses would then come forward and say they saw Irvin enter a storage unit that was rented by him and Joel. The witnesses said he was not alone and was with a woman who looked like Brenda. They saw them enter the unit between 5:45 and 6 p.m., but they never saw them leave. However, by 6:30 p.m., they noticed the man's car was gone. When investigators searched the storage, they found blood on a small pink stuffed animal. They also found semen and saliva on Brenda's body that was the same type as Irvin's. Agnella Lee, who was a roommate of Brenda and Joel's, came forward and said that Brenda admitted to having a side fling with Irvin, but assumed she was joking. She told her that she had to meet with Irvin that day to get something from him for Joel. It's possible the two had a consensual sexual encounter at the storage unit before he strangled her to death. Irvin claimed he was not at the storage unit, but he and Joel were the only two people with the keys. Instead, he said he left the stadium after speaking with Brenda and went to the store to buy film, returning 15 minutes later. Investigators weren't buying it, and a couple of weeks after Brenda's murder, they arrested Irvin and charged him with second-degree murder. In a shocking twist, Irvin was acquitted because Joel and her mother testified that he was at the game the entire time. That would sadly be the biggest mistake of Joel's life. After being acquitted, Irvin dropped out of school and returned home. Meanwhile, Joel moved to Memphis in April of 1988, where she got a job as a manager at the Lady Foot Locker in the Mall of Memphis. Irvin joined her a month later, and the two began living together. Almost 1 year later, on May 19, 1989, Irvin called the police and reported Joel missing. A month later, on June 11th, Joel's skeletal remains were found, wrapped in a sheet, in a field in Arkansas, about 25 miles from Memphis. Investigators were able to locate the matching sheets in Joel and Irvin's apartment, and he was subsequently placed at the top of the suspect list. However, Irvin was nowhere to be found. In March of 1991, a woman named Valerie Crawford came forward and told police that her former boyfriend had confessed to killing two women and said he would do the same to her. That boyfriend was none other than Irvin Bolden Jr. Once the New Jersey officers had him in custody, he shockingly confessed to murdering Brenda and Joel. He said that after he and Brenda entered the storage unit, she kept saying that she was going to be with Joel no matter what. He said he got so angry, he strangled her to death. As for Joel, he said he murdered her on May 18, 1989, during an argument at their apartment. After being extradited back to Memphis, he pleaded guilty to voluntary manslaughter for the murder of Joel and was sentenced to 10 years in prison. However, he couldn't be charged for Brenda's murder because he had already been tried and found not guilty. Instead, they charged him with perjury, and in January 1995, he was found guilty. He received another 7 years, but the sentences were allowed to run concurrently, and he was released in November of 1998. Donna Ellen Winger was born on November 10, 1963, in Hollywood, Florida, to parents Jane and Cash Brown. In 1989, 26-year-old Donna married Mark Winger, and the couple moved to Springfield, Illinois. By 1995, Donna, now 31 years old, was working as an operating room technician, while Mark worked as a nuclear engineer. At this point, Donna felt the only thing missing in her life was a child, but she had sadly discovered she was unable to get pregnant and was naturally devastated. She then began looking into adoption and eventually got a call from the hospital about a teenager looking to have her baby adopted. On June 1, 1995, she and Mark adopted the baby girl and named her Bailey. 2 months later, she took Bailey on a trip to Florida to visit family. Afterward, they flew to St. Louis and hopped in a cab for a 2-hour ride back to Springfield. During the ride, the cab driver, Roger Harrington, allegedly began flirting with Donna and talking about drugs and orgies. He also strangely told her that he had a voice in his head named Dom, and that Dom was telling him to do bad things like hurt people. After Donna safely arrived home with Bailey, she called the transit company and reported Roger's behavior, and he was subsequently suspended. She also informed Mark of the ordeal. 6 days later, in a shocking turn of events, Mark invited Roger over to their home, saying he wanted to help him get his job back. On August 29th, Roger showed up at the Winger home with a cup of coffee and a pack of cigarettes. When he walked inside, he was immediately shot twice. Mark then called 911 and told them that he shot a man who was trying to kill his wife. He said he was on the treadmill in the basement when he heard a commotion upstairs. He claimed he grabbed his gun and found Roger attacking Donna with a hammer and then shot him. When the police arrived, they found that Donna had been hit in the head around 7 times with a hammer. Sadly, neither Donna nor Roger would survive their injuries. When they questioned Mark and were told about Donna's encounter with Roger, they took it at face value and closed the case. Now that Mark was raising his infant daughter alone, Donna's family suggested that he hire a nanny. In January of 1996, he met 23-year-old Rebecca Simic, who was searching for a nanny job. Rebecca would turn out to be amazing with Bailey, and Donna's family loved her. Rebecca and Mark then formed a relationship, and within a year, she was pregnant. They then eloped to Hawaii and married in October of 1996. Rebecca felt uneasy in the home where Donna and Roger died, so they moved to a suburb outside of Springfield. Rebecca continued raising Bailey and the 3 children she and Mark had together. In 1999, Mark was very sick, so Rebecca rushed him to the emergency room at the hospital where Donna used to work. It was there she saw Donna's best friend and co-worker, Deanne Schultz, who was upset at the sight of Mark. This wasn't the first time Rebecca had encountered Deanne. When she was first hired on as Bailey's nanny, Deanne was there helping out with Bailey. After arriving back home, Mark told Rebecca that it was probably not the last time they would hear from her. Turns out he was right, and in February of 1999, Deanne went to the police and told them that Mark and she were having an affair before Donna's murder. She even said that Mark told her things would be easier in life if Donna were dead. Mark went even further and told Deanne that he needed to get Roger to the house to help with his plan. However, she never took him seriously until the day Roger was shot and Donna was murdered. Over time, the secret was eating away at her, and she even tried to take her own life. Now that the police had this new information, they decided to take another look at the case and began to notice things they hadn't thought about before. Why were there no signs of forced entry? Why did Roger bring a cup of coffee and cigarettes if he planned to murder Donna? Plus, Roger had a knife and tire iron in his car, so why would he use Mark's hammer? Then they noticed that Donna and Roger's bodies were in a position that didn't match up with Mark's version of events. At this point, they knew they had gotten the case wrong and realized Mark was most likely the murderer. On August 23, 2001, Mark Winger was indicted and charged with their murders. During the trial, Deanne testified against Mark, and he was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. To make matters worse, in 2005, he attempted to hire a hitman to kill Deanne, as well as a childhood friend who refused to bail him out. He was then given 35 more years on top of the life sentence. Afterward, Rebecca moved the four children out of Springfield and helped reunite Bailey with Donna's family. Emmette St. Guyon was born in Boston, Massachusetts on March 2, 1981. Emmette graduated from Boston Latin School in 1999 and then moved to Washington, D.C. to attend George Washington University. She was originally majoring in forensic psychology, but changed it to criminal justice because she wanted to change public policy to improve the lives of prison inmates. In 2003, she graduated magna cum laude and then enrolled at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City to pursue her master's degree. In 2006, 24-year-old Emmette was scheduled to graduate in May, but unfortunately, tragedy struck. On the night of February 24th, Emmette was out with her friend Claire, celebrating her upcoming birthday by bar hopping around the city. By 3:30 a.m., Claire was tired and went home, while Emmette went alone to a local bar called The Falls. Around 4 a.m., when the bar was closing, the bouncer, Daryl Littlejohn, escorted her outside. After that, she was never seen alive again. Later that day, at around 8:43 p.m., a 911 dispatcher received a call reporting a body had been found in Brooklyn. When the police arrived, they found Emmette's nude body wrapped in a blanket with a sock stuffed in her mouth. Her hands and feet were bound, her hair was cut off, and her head was completely covered with tape hiding her face. She had sadly been sexually assaulted, strangled, and suffocated to death. Forensic psychologist Dr. Stephanie Stalinsky noted that covering her face with tape was typical in killers who wanted to dehumanize their victims. As investigators were retracing Emmette's steps, they realized that Daryl Littlejohn, the bouncer at the bar, was possibly the last person to see her alive. When they looked into him, they discovered that he had spent more than 12 years behind bars for drug possession and robbery. He also had multiple aliases, such as Daryl Banks, John Handsome, and Jonathan Blaze. At the time of Emmett's murder, he was on parole and had a 9 p.m. curfew, which he was violating by working as a bouncer. Investigators had discovered blood on the ties that bound Emmett's hands and had it checked against Daryl's blood, and it was a match. Daryl had a history of nosebleeds, and they believe one occurred during the attack, which led to the blood on the ties. They also found carpet fibers on the tape used to cover Emmett's face that matched fibers from his home. There was also forensic DNA evidence on the blanket that linked to Daryl's brother, Reggie, who had died in 1994, and a hair from Daryl's mother. Clearly, the blanket had not been washed in over 12 years if it still had his brother's fluid on it. They also looked at Daryl's cell phone records, and it showed he was at the location of Emmett's body. While in that area, he had placed multiple calls between 7:15 and 8 p.m., Daryl was then arrested and charged with the sexual assault and murder of Emmette. Emmette was not Daryl's first victim, and solving this case would lead investigators to solve two other cases as well. When they collected DNA evidence from his van, it linked back to a woman named Shania Woodward, who was kidnapped and beaten in October of 2005. During the trial, she testified that Daryl was impersonating a police officer when he abducted her. Another woman came forward and said she was also attacked by a man impersonating a police officer in Queens, New York. She said just like Emmett, he wrapped her head with duct tape before sexually assaulting her. While she never got a clear look at his face, he did give her a t-shirt, and DNA from that shirt linked right back to Daryl. Daryl was first tried for the kidnapping of Shanai Woodward and was found guilty and sentenced to 25 years to life. He was then tried for Emmett's murder in 2009 and found guilty. He was then sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. To this day, he's never been tried for the third assault, but remains in prison, unable to hurt another innocent victim. Kaylee Ann Poulton was born the only child to Judy Gifford and David Poulton on September 20, 1989. By May of 1994, 4-year-old Kaylee was living with her mother in an apartment complex in Rochester, New York, after her parents separated. On May 23rd, at about 6:45 p.m., Kaylee asked her mother if she could go outside and ride her big wheel. Since it was still daylight and other children were still outside playing, her mother agreed but told her to remain in front of the apartment. Once outside, Kaylee began riding up and down the sidewalk out front. Meanwhile, Judy was busy getting her magazines ready for delivery that evening. She had taken on the second part-time job because she was trying to save enough money to take Kaylee to Disney World the following summer. Sadly, she would never get the chance. Once Judy was done, which wasn't long after Kaylee had gone outside, she loaded the magazines in the car and was ready to do her deliveries. However, when she hollered for Kaylee, there was no answer. Judy's heart sank because she immediately knew something was wrong. She began frantically going through the complex, yelling Kaylee's name, and neighbors even joined in on the search. About 20 minutes later, Judy saw 25-year-old Mark Christie, who had moved into the complex about 6 weeks earlier with his girlfriend, Lacey Ann Newton, at the playground with his 18-month-old son, Alex. She noticed his high-top sneakers were untied and found that strange, almost like he put them on in a hurry. She then asked if he had seen Kaylee, to which he quickly responded no, and continued about his business. At that point, Judy called 911 and reported Kaylee missing. Authorities brought in tracker dogs, searched the grounds, and went door to door, but still, there was no sign of Kaylee. Investigators initially looked at Judy and brought her in for questioning. During their interview, she mentioned her neighbor Mark and described a strange encounter she had with him. She said that one day, he asked Judy if Kaylee would tell her if anyone tried to touch her. Judy said of course she would, but found the question rather odd and alarming. Mark was then interviewed, given a polygraph, and passed. Since they didn't have anything to tie him to Kaylee's disappearance, they let him go. A few days later, Mark was evicted after the complex received complaints about him exposing himself to two young girls. Mark also had a criminal history that dates back to his teenage years. Neighbors of his back then said he would walk around with guns and knives and had even shot out home and car windows with a BB gun. Even though investigators felt he was a promising suspect, the police wrote him off because Judy had seen him at the playground with his son around the time Kaylee went missing. Regardless, two investigators with the department felt Mark was the right man and continued to keep track of him. Judy then spent the next 2 years searching for her daughter and keeping the case in the public eye. Finally, on August 9, 1996, police got the break they were looking for. During an argument between Mark and Lacey, who had only been married now for 3 weeks, he let it slip that he murdered Kaylee. He said it, hoping to gain sympathy from her, but it had the complete opposite effect. Horrified, she took her son and fled to her father's home, where she called 911. Unfortunately, New York considers admissions to your spouse protected by law, and so investigators were left to come up with a different plan to get a confession from him. One of those investigators was Crow, who believed for the last 2 years that Mark was the primary suspect and drove to his home to interview him. When he arrived, Mark's mother tried to get him to leave by telling him that Mark had an attorney. She also instructed her son not to talk to the investigators. Regardless, Mark agreed to sit down with Crow, but said he wouldn't divulge anything until he spoke with his attorney first. While Crow attempted to sway him otherwise, Mark was adamant. During the drive to Rochester, Crow asked Mark if he wanted to get some lunch first. Mark agreed, and so they went to an Italian restaurant called Ronzoni's. During the meal, Mark confessed that all the media coverage and missing posters for Kaylee had been haunting him. He then finally confessed to the horrific crime. He said he saw Kaylee riding her big wheel outside his apartment and invited her inside to play with his son, Alex. Once inside, she went upstairs to where Alex was while Mark placed her big wheel in the kitchen. He then went upstairs and entered his bedroom across the hall from Alex's room. Once he heard Judy screaming for Kaylee, he panicked and strangled her to death. He then took her body, laid it on the dining room floor, and went to the playground with Alex. When he returned to his apartment a few minutes later, he wrapped Kaylee in a blanket, placed her in a basket, and took the basket to the trunk of his car. He said he was able to do this without getting caught because of the chaos outside and the fact that nobody was paying attention to what he was doing. After Kaylee's body was in his trunk, he drove to his place of employment, climbed to the top of the enclosed 30,000-gallon water tank, and dropped her in with a piece of heavy equipment tied to her. He then kept her big wheel in his apartment for 3 days, cutting it into small pieces and hiding them throughout his home. Because of this, the police never located the pieces, even after a thorough search. He then put the pieces in duffel bags, stuffed with clothing, and distributed them throughout the county. One thing Mark never mentioned was a possible sexual assault, which investigator Crow feels that he purposely left out. Once he had the confession, he drove Mark to the police station where he was charged with Kaylee's murder. Authorities then had the water tank drained and found poor little Kaylee's body. When all was said and done, Mark took a plea deal and received 25 years to life in prison. However, the story doesn't end here. Years later, Mark's DNA was linked to the murder of 74-year-old Viola Manville, who was shot with a BB gun and beaten to death in 1988. While Mark was a prime suspect in the case, after he bragged to friends about the crime, Frank Sterling would be convicted in 1991 due to a videotaped false confession. Frank spent 19 years in prison before being exonerated.
Is hereby ordered to be released from the custody of the Department of Corrections.
Cheers in our Rochester courtroom today as Frank Sterling was exonerated for the 1988 murder of Viola Manville.
As for Mark, in October of 2011, he was given another 20 years to life. Unfortunately, New York is now proposing the Elder Parole Law, which would allow Mark to be released in 2027. However, as of now, the law is still pending in the New York State Senate. If this law never goes into effect, he won't be eligible for parole until 2041. In 1994, Herbert Baumeister's 13-year-old son Eric found a human skull and collection of bones while playing on the family's Fox Hollow Farms estate in Westfield, Indiana. Herbert told his wife the bones were most likely from an old medical skeleton that his late father, who was an anesthesiologist, used. While the bones concerned Julia, she eventually forgot about them until the following November when police showed up asking for permission to search the property as part of their investigation into a string of murders of young gay men in the area. A young man had identified her husband Herbert as the man who almost suffocated him to death during a sexual encounter at the estate. However, Herbert refused to let them search. At this point, Julia was once again concerned and was starting to believe her husband was possibly the killer. It wasn't helped by the fact that they had only had sex 3 times during their marriage, and she had never seen him fully nude. So, when Herbert left out of town in June of 1996, she allowed authorities onto the property to search. The search would result in 10,000 charred and pulverized bone fragments. After the search, they issued a warrant for his arrest. He then took his own life in a public park in Canada. Herbert is now suspected of killing at least 25 young men during the 1980s and 1990s. One of those men was 27-year-old Alan Lee Livingston, who disappeared on August 6, 1993. Herbert had been a suspect in his disappearance since he fit his victim's profile. In 2022, Alan's mother, Sharon, now in poor health, was desperate to find answers to her son's disappearance. She was convinced that Herbert murdered Allen and that his remains were part of the bones found on the property. So her family reached out to the Hamilton County coroner, Jeff Jillison, and asked if they could compare their DNA to the remaining unidentified remains from the Fox Hollow farm. Jellison agreed and selected 44 bones to test. They were shocked when the first bone they tested linked to Allen. This now makes the 9th confirmed victim of Herbert Baumeister. Allen's family is thankful to finally have some long-awaited closure. Thanks for joining me today on Southern Girl Crime Stories. Please be sure to check out my YouTube channel for these stories, along with photos of victims, suspects, location of murders, and more. As always, your support is very much appreciated, and I look forward to seeing y'all next time.